Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. We're again in this heart-wrenching story from Genesis 22 about how Abraham was tested by God. Last week, we considered this story from Abraham's perspective. We thought about how extreme this test was. Would Abraham give up the greatest gift he's received from God, his only son, Isaac? We looked at how in the culture surrounding Abraham, child sacrifice sadly did happen. But the point of this story was to say, no, but for God to say, no, I don't require this. I'll provide another way, an alternative, a substitute. We also marveled at the wholehearted and complete obedience of Abraham to this strange command of God, and how at the climax of his life, it showed and demonstrated his faith in God. This week, we're going to instead look at the story from Isaac's perspective. So if you're not here last week, do look up last week's sermon on the internet to fill in the details. But when we look at it from Isaac's point of view, we're giving ourselves a little bit of a harder task, because this passage is resolutely about Abraham and God. When Jonathan gave me the opportunity of a second week to talk about this passage, I had to split it up in some ways. So we are looking at Isaac this week. And there's two very good reasons to look at Isaac this week. The Israelites, who would be the first people reading this passage, would have very much identified with Isaac. He was their forefather. And as his life was threatened, their very existence was threatened too in this story. And it has a very straightforward message for them. When their existence is threatened, God will provide. But for us today, also, when we look at this passage, we see many echoes going forward to the story of Jesus' death. This story has been described as the first pencil sketches of a future masterpiece. And so in reflecting on this story, we hope to be drawn deeper into the mystery of Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, where God once again provided, where God provided for all humans who will believe, whose very existence was threatened by the spectre of death brought on by their own wrongdoing. So firstly, what we're going to do is have a little look at Isaac, his wider story. Then we're going to look back at Isaac's experience in this story and how it speaks to us of Jesus' story. And finally, we'll consider our place in this story. But first to Isaac's story. In thinking about any Bible passage, it's helpful to consider, in fact, it's fundamental to consider it in the light of the rest of that book that it's in and the rest of the Bible. This helps us in this story where Isaac only has a slight part. He has a big part, but we only know some of it. We can turn to the rest of his life to interpret his actions and words. But even in the whole of Genesis, Isaac is a little bit of an enigma. He's almost just simply a link person between Abraham, his father, and his sons Jacob and Esau. The two great stories that he's a part of, he barely appears in. The first is his birth. A lot is talked about the birth of Isaac, but obviously he only appears right at the end of that story. But also in his marriage to Rebekah, which is quite a long story, but again, he only appears at the end. It's Abraham's servant that goes off and shows faith in going to get Isaac a wife. Indeed, Isaac's life story seems in some ways to basically be a replay of his father's life story. We see so many common incidents. He and Rebekah, like Abraham and Sarah, struggle to have children. We see their children fighting. We see God making almost the same promises to him as to Abraham. We see Isaac making the same mistake as his father Abraham in saying that his wife was his sister. And he has that story happens with the same foreign king. He then has very similar disagreements about Wales with that same king and then makes a treaty with him. All these things are very similar to what happened to Abraham. Many of the main events of Isaac's life replay the events of his father Abraham's life. But what is unique about him? Well, I think one of the things we do see is the evidence of a real faith in God, right from the start of his story. The next time we meet him, as Rebekah is coming into his life, we find him out in the fields at evening, meditating on God. He's also the only patriarch to have but one wife and no concubines. And of all the husbands in the Old Testament who have barren wives, Isaac's prayer for a child is the only one mentioned as being answered by God. So that's the context in which we come to this story, where Isaac just goes along with it. And we could just see that in many different lights, him going along with his father Abraham. But I think the context tells us that this is out of a place of faith in God, already present as a young man. It also suggests to us that this early episode in his life, which we might think as very horrific for him, didn't dent his trust in God to any great extent. So we have Isaac, in some ways an enigma, in many ways his father's son, a man clearly of faith in God, but one who makes mistakes too. So now let us turn to consider the story before us today, to look at Isaac's experience alongside Jesus's experience. The first thing we discover from this story is who Isaac is. This comes in verse 2. God calls him Abraham's son, his only son Isaac, the son whom he loves. He is Abraham's son. But in particular, he is the son through whom God's promises would come. In that practical sense, he was Abraham's only son, even though Abraham did have another physical son. In fact, God says that twice more in verses 12 and 16, your only son. It's maybe why we read so much about the goings-on around Isaac in Genesis and not so much about the man himself, because he functions as a symbol of God's promises in these stories of Abraham. And it's here that the echoes of Jesus start too. He even more so embodies the promises of God. He is a symbol of that promise, but also the fulfillment of those promises. So he is that in so much more of a deep and complete way. And he also was actually God's only son, as we know. But as Isaac seems to be an extension of Abraham, in his likeness, if you like, doing the same things, that is even more the case for Jesus. He was even more in the likeness of God because he was God in person. So when we see Jesus doing things, we see what God would do. And when we hear Jesus speaking, we hear the very words of God. And interestingly, this verse is echoed in Jesus' own story at his baptism. At the start of the gospel accounts of his life, God speaks from heaven saying, "You are my beloved son," which can also mean only son, "with you I am well pleased." So we start by finding out who Isaac is. The next thing we see about Isaac in this story in verses 3 to 10 is his submission. Isaac is pictured as being submissive in this passage. He does everything his father asks him to. He goes along with him. He walks with him. He carries the wood for him. And when we get to verse 9 and Isaac is bound by Abraham, we know Isaac must have had to be actively submitting to Abraham at that point, because the likelihood is that Isaac was a teenager already by that point. Even if he was even slightly younger, he would already have been easily able to struggle and get away from his father, who by that point was very old. Isaac must have been aware of what was going on and be willing to be a part of it by that point. If Abraham demonstrated extreme obedience, then Isaac demonstrates to us extreme submission, both to his father and also to God, just as Jesus does. An earlier snippet backs this up. In verse 6, we are told that they went on together. They did this together, although the story wants to focus on Abraham. Indeed, in verse 6, we have another echo of Jesus' story as the wood is placed on Isaac's back, as the cross was placed on Jesus' back. Even non-Christian scholars have noticed how that is so similar to the condemned man carrying their cross. In both Isaac's case and Jesus' case, we have willing submission to the will of their father. And in both cases, it's not a picture of a mean father imposing something on a reluctant son, but a picture of father and son working together in ready agreement so that obedience might be done and a perfect sacrifice offered to God. We come then to the one really explicit part Isaac has in the story, his question to Abraham in verse 7. Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Within this story, it seems the question is mostly there to give Abraham an opportunity to express his faith in God's provision. God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. And Isaac's reaction is not recorded, except that we don't read about any more questions, but just that they continued on together. Maybe by this point, Isaac was sharing that same faith in God as he continued with his father. Jesus too spoke to his father just before his death. Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. This is maybe as far as we get with the parallel between Isaac and Jesus. In Isaac and Jesus, there's similar mixtures of consent, but also apprehension. But Jesus certainly knew where he was heading. So we have Isaac's submission. But then, after we look at this parallel between Jesus and Isaac, and we turn to the second half of this passage in verses 8 to 19, Isaac's story takes a different turn and has a different conclusion to that of Jesus's. Isaac, in the end, is spared as God provides a ram to be sacrificed in his place. It is both God's provision that the ram was there and his provision that Abraham hadn't noticed it up to that point. And the book of Hebrews describes this point in the story as a type of resurrection, of life out of death for Isaac. But for Jesus himself, he actually did need to die in the place of humans before he rose to new life again. And also his death was like the ram's death, in that he died in the place of us, of humans, just as that ram died in the place of Isaac. This idea of one dying in the place of another is pictured here as the way in which God provides for his people. It's fundamental to the Christian story. Notice no one had to tell Abraham to make that substitution of the ram for his son. He recognized that something else or someone else could stand in another person's place. This truth then formed the backbone of the later temple system of sacrifices. Justice required a consequence for human wrongdoing, and God decreed that that punishment be death. But God also provided a way for substitution to happen. Animals were offered in the place of people. A ram, in fact, was offered as people confessed their sins and wanted to return to a right relationship with God and neighbor. But as Hebrews reminds us also, it's impossible for the blood of animals to really take away human sin. And so we have in this passage a deep tension. God does not want human sacrifice, as we read about last week. But humans only in the end, human sacrifice does. It's humans that made the mess, and we must bear the consequences. But even then, God was not going to require it of us, but gave himself instead. He came as a human being to die in our place, as that human, in his beloved son, Jesus. And so as Jesus willingly sacrificed himself, God provided a complete substitute to rescue us from all our wrongdoing, all our sin, and the spiritual death to which they lead. Jesus is everywhere hinted at in this passage, but particularly in the willing submission of Isaac and the ram who is the substitute. There's so much more I could say, but it's already 11 o'clock. But in this story of Isaac, we see a pencil sketch of Jesus' greater story as we see Isaac's submission to his father. And we see a God who can be trusted to be providing for our ultimate spiritual well-being. So what might we take away from this today? Lastly, we considered the obedience of Abraham. This week, we consider the submission of Isaac. And our faith is shown both in active obedience and also passive submission. Sometimes we have to be active and push on and go on and do things for God, following his call and command. At other times, we have to simply stand firm with a God-given resolve in faith, resisting, like Jesus and Isaac did, the temptation to flee. In particular, we stand firm in all those little and big sacrifices we've decided to make as part of following Jesus. Things which might make us look different to the world around us and mean we are misunderstood and ridiculed. For instance, at a very basic place, making church a priority, but many other things too. We might want to give in and be like everyone else, but Isaac's experience tells us God will provide. He will honour our submission, our stand for him. He will provide for us in eternity when we are given resurrection life like that Jesus won for us. And he will provide strength for us in the here and now when we need it. Abraham and Isaac had to return to normal life after this story. It all seems somewhat of an anticlimax. But in Jesus' story, after his death and resurrection, nothing was the same again. God's new life and new creation had entered the world. Hope had dawned in a new way. There was now the possibility of life on the other side of death. So through every storm that we face, we can trust in a God who has already defeated death. And because of that, we know that in the end, every storm will be stilled, every shadow pass, and when the new day dawns, when the sun shines, it will shine out brighter, because God, our provider, has already shown that through the very darkest events of life here on earth, he can provide for our good and glory. Amen.